My name's Damien Rowland. I'm a paediatric emergency medicine consultant from the Leicester Royal Infirmary. That's in the middle of the UK, if you're not sure where it is. And I'm here speaking to Nate Cooperman. Nate, tell us a bit about yourself.
So I'm Nate Cooperman. I'm a paediatric emergency physician at the University of California in Davis, which is in Northern California. I also serve as the chair of it's actually a general emergency department in which the pediatric emergency department is embedded, you know, physically separate, but I chair both the adult and the pediatric side, although I am a pediatric trained pediatric emergency physician. But I spend probably two thirds of my time doing research, and the vast majority of that research is collaborative research, looking at better ways to manage acutely ill and injured children.
Fantastic. And I'll just get straight to the point. So you've been involved in some pretty big studies over the years on some really important subjects, diabetic ketoacidosis, heterogeneity, for example. Just a couple of the challenges that you've had in getting some ideas that you may have come up with 15, 20 years ago, and getting something into practice so that everyone is using it.
Yeah, great. So let me tell you one story that is about diabetic ketoacidosis. We'll call it DKA for ease of discussion. So my wife, who you know, Damien, is a pediatric endocrinologist, she and I started looking at the management of DKA. It was 25 years ago when we took care of a child together. I think we were in training, who presented with DKA, but in fulminant cerebral edema. We had to intubate the child. We hadn't even touched the child, and was very dehydrated, had been vomiting. And we thought, wow, this is weird. We were always taught that if you give too much fluid, that's what causes cerebral edema. And here this child presents in fulminant cerebral edema, walking in the ED without even an IV in. So we started down this path. And so I'll just tell you two stories that address your question. So after some survey research, whatnot, we did a case control study, a big study, retrospective, but we looked at through about 7,000 charts of children with diabetic ketoacidosis in 15 centers in the United States and one in Melbourne. A colleague in Melbourne participated as well. But it was a multivariable analysis, and we looked at lots of factors, and there was only four factors that were associated with DKA-related cerebral edema, and none of them were fluid. It wasn't the insulin. It wasn't the fluid. The risk factors were factors regarding the severity of illness, so high BUN, so dehydrated children, acidotic. The administration of bicarb was associated. That was the one modifiable factor. So it was a big publication, but it was just retrospectively done. But nonetheless, it showed that fluid, it didn't matter at all. Well, it got published in a high-profile publication. But what happened was people stopped administering bicarbonate. That they did. But fluid management didn't change. And fluid management has always been very restrictive in the United States and I think around the world based on, I don't want to call it bad research, but it was case series, you know, the study that really drove fluid management in DKA before this was just a case series of 40 children with DKA cerebral edema without controls. And the investigators concluded that fluid causes cerebral edema in a single case series. So, but just ratchet ahead, 20 more. Yeah, sorry, go ahead. Yeah.
Well, I'm just going to nip in there. It is interesting, though. So there's a lot of parallels at the moment with COVID and data inequality. We're learning stuff really fast. No one wants to believe what they're seeing because it doesn't accord with their prior beliefs. And I suppose when you did that case control, it was still retrospective. So I suppose you didn't have to concede yourself that although it looked like fluid wasn't the thing, what you really needed to do was a prospective study.
Right. So thanks, Damien. So absolutely, we did not think that there was the definitive study by any means. The one thing, though, that was interesting is that, again, this thing, issue about bicarbonate, it was a strong factor associated. So, but we had no misconceptions that we were going to change the fluid world on a retrospective study. So you're absolutely right. So we knew that to really impact, you know, change, we really needed to make sure and do a bunch of prospective stuff. So, you know, over 20 years, we have an animal model of DKA, a rat model of DKA, and we're studying children with DKA with real-time, you know, a sophisticated MR imaging, you know, all these studies that led to this big clinical trial that, you know, was published a couple years ago. And interesting, because this gets to the point that you're raising about changing behavior. So we studied, you know, after 20 years of work, everything that we did pointed to what's causing cerebral injury, we call it in DKA, was hypoperfusion. That is, you know, underperfusion of the brain leading to then vasogenic edema, which would argue for early in disease, do not restrict fluid. You have to reperfuse the brain. So, you know, we have 20 years of data from little rats and little children and whatnot. So then we went to PCARN, the network that I love and have been participating in for 20 years, to do this randomized trial of fast fluid versus slow fluid. There were 18 sites in PCARN at the time. And what we proposed, we could only get 4 sites in PCARN to agree to it because they were scared. I mean, this is a research network, right? Because despite 20 years of pilot data, they had the belief that was instilled in us 30 years ago on single case series. I mean, really, that they were not going to mess with their protocol. So then what we had to do is we had to bring the arms a little bit closer. The slow arm a little faster and the fast arm a little bit slower. And then finally, we got 13 sites out of 18. We still didn't get them all, but 13, we could hit our sample size and do our trial. Okay, so we did our trial and it showed what it showed, that a fast fluid is not associated with a cerebral injury. There was, you know, some point estimate suggestions, in fact, the other direction, but didn't achieve statistical significance. But the point was, is that we showed that fluid is not a factor. But in the meantime, others and we have shown that, you know, hypoperfusion is bad for the brain. AKI, that is acute kidney injury, happens in about 40% of kids with DKA. The kidneys need to be perfused. So here we are now. We have like all this now prospective data, and then we have to get to implementation. So first I had to convince PCARN investigators to do the trial because of myth. It's not myth. Myth might be too strong a word, but data that was dogma. Been very dogma, limited.
I think is
the word. Dogma, thank you. Dogma is the better word. Thank you. So dogma really based on very limited single, you know, case series data. But finally, after, you know, doing the prospective randomized trial and then with the help of implementation scientists who now have, you know, emerged. And, you know, I mentioned Terry Klassen, a good friend who runs the TREC network, really an implementation science network in Canada. They pushed, you know, we were working with them the day that article was published. They pushed the data to all of their community EDs in Canada. And we do not have that sort of a sophisticated implementation network in the United States. We try to do it through PCARN, but now we're sort of starting to break the barriers of dogma because a prospective randomized trial is a powerful tool, but that by itself, as you know, can't do it. So we needed people like Terry, the implementers. We've now embedded it into the electronic health record because, you know, implementation scientists have shown that the best way to elicit change, it's got to be point of care decision support in addition to audit and feedback and a sort of a multi-pronged approach. And now people are finally doing what like 20 years and millions of dollars of research said, if the child is sick and dehydrated, give them fluid. Period. That was the end of, you know, 20, you know, 5 years of research. But the issue of pushing dogma, both from scientists that, you know, that have their own beliefs on top of clinicians who are ultimately caring for the children.
I mean, this concept of dogma is amazing because even for COVID and especially in the interactions that I've had outside of the emergency department about how COVID must be a disease that affects children. It must be like flu. There's all this, it must do this because that's what we've always believed and always done. and then we actually learn that COVID doesn't affect children so much, and it probably isn't transmitted as much. And so, if you had your time again, so you keep saying 20 years, and I sense your, oh my God, it's taken 20 years to do this. Do you think if you did the whole thing again, you could make it shorter? Or do you think actually it was always going to take that body of evidence and body of implementation?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And I think it depends on the topic and the degree of the embeddedness of the dogma. So DKA, it was embedded and embedded hard. All around the world, we were taught fluid causes cerebral edema, and that was a really hard one to break. So I think, I mean, we might have shortened it a bit, but I don't think much. I think we had to take this stepwise approach. What has been greatly, you know, and I alluded to this earlier, what I do think we've made great progress in is the issue around implementation science. That is, there are people now that are really have more sophisticated means to get good data. That is, you know, once people like you and others who are sophisticated consumers and reviewers of evidence, we can get that evidence into practice shorter than, you know, the classic story is, you know, the zipper. I mean, the zipper is a, got one on my coat right now. It's a great little device. But before zippers got implemented onto clothes, it was 50 years between the development of the zipper and putting it on clothes, right? But now we have gotten that, I think, that time frame between discovery that is, you know, legitimate based on, you know, hierarchy of evidence into practice. That has been shortened. But I do think that the DKA story probably required what we did to overcome the level of dogma that was associated with it.
Yeah, excellent. So I want to just take a slight move away from DKA, but keeping on this theme of implementation, and let's take the febrile infant, for example. Mm-hmm. Where you spend a lot of time, especially with PECN, developing rules. And a lot of what I've been involved in now is international collaborations and spreading work internationally. Where do you think the balance lies between things that are developed locally and or at a countrywide basis and rules and algorithms that are done internationally? Because I think this is an interesting point, is that you've got your kind of febrile infant rule, that the Europeans have one, the Australians are making one. Where do we go over the next 5 to 10 years? Is there ever going to be one rule that fits all? Or are we still always going to be constrained by a kind of national local tendencies?
Right. So this is, this is another, I think that is a really important question that we, in the international community, that we actually need a symposium around this. This is my feeling about, you know, international collaborations, and I have many, you know, as you know, because, you know, we both work in PERN, the Pediatric Emergency Research Network, which is, as you know, a big international network. But this is what my feeling, like the febrile infant rules, the Spaniards, you know, with Santimantegui, they have a good rule. PECARN, we have a good rule. Others will develop another good rule. But see, my feeling is, it's not that one rule is going to be substantially better than another rule. What they are, the important thing, is they're breaking from dogma. Because historically, how we manage the febrile infant, we said, oh, if you have a white count cut off between 5,000 and 15,000, those numbers appeared out of nowhere. They're just cute, rounded numbers. That's not really, and then, of course, everyone is just doing their own thing. For me, the issue is, I just want to help investigators make decisions based on evidence. It doesn't matter to me so much whether it's a PECARN rule, step-by-step rule, or some other rule. The point is that we need our clinical judgment, but it has to be informed by good evidence. So, and all of these rules are good. You know, there's nuances, there's differences, slight differences between the both. I'm not a big fan of comparing my rule to others. In fact, I've never done that for that one reason, because I don't think that's productive. What I think is productive is to convince clinicians to use evidence, whether it's, you know, whatever rule. So a good example, I think, for international collaboration. recently, and as you know, because UKIPA did this as well, we have three big studies on status epilepticus, on what is the right second-line agent after benzodiazepines. Australia, New Zealand published one, UK published one, PCARM published one. They all sort of show the same thing. To be quite honest, I think that was a tremendous waste of resources because we're all doing these big trials, and I'm a believer in scientists and the data. There's no reason to think that they should be different as long as the trials are big, randomized. What I think is a much better use of international collaboration is when you don't have enough sample size in one country to do the study. So an example that I'm involved with right now, and Pern is involved with, we have a study of normal saline versus lactated Ringer's or plasmolite for sepsis. We didn't have, to get to our sample size, we need big numbers, bigger than we have within PCARN. So this is a great collaboration between Australia and New Zealand, PCARN and PERC, which is the Canadian Research Network. We're collaborating together because we need to do that to get our sample size. And of course, it adds some generalizability, et cetera. But for topics that are big enough to be studied in one network, my feeling is we should divide and conquer. So let's say Peruki in the UK and PCARN, you know, we're interested in a topic around concussion, for example, rather than replicating each other and each creating prediction rules that are not, are fundamentally not going to be that different. They'll both be good. And rather, I think a better use of global intellectual and financial resources, divide the issues. And you guys take on one question, let us take on another question. So for the same amount of intellectual and financial resource, we can answer more things than just replicating what each other does, because all of those, all that evidence, like I said, it's all going to be good. So that's just my general feeling about if that, I don't know if that exactly answered your question, but that's my feeling about that.
Well, I mean, I think it's really, really interesting. And again, just so the, good examples, I suppose, for come out of the UK at the moment for our work on COVID, because we have established in the UK through the recovery trial that the way that on an en masse study that is providing data for the rest of the world. And if other countries were doing different things that we could use as well, you'd maximize your gain. I just, this use of kind of guidance is really interesting. So I was presenting at kind of a Don't Forget the Bubbles conference and sharing some of your PCARM work on the febrile neonate. I think it was, I can't remember the name of which one it was, but the under 60 days one, where you pretty conclusively shown that if you ask the clinician before they do everything what they think the risk of SBI is, we're rubbish. And it doesn't matter how experienced you are, the match between the 0, 5, 10, and 50% risk in no way corresponded to the actual chance that child had an infection. So we need some rules because we can't do it, even if you've been in this game for 30 or 40 years. And I think that's really powerful. It's just quite
Interesting. That's an excellent example of this notion of, you know, what we think we're good at versus not. And that's why my passion, of course, I'm an evidence generator. I do some implementation, but I do more evidence generation. But when I talk about the febrile infant, you know, under 60 days, I don't say to use the PCARN rule. I don't say to use a step-by-step rule. I said, use some evidence, okay? You can pick the rule. I don't care. But I want you to use evidence because our clinical judgment is just not good. And if you use the evidence, you'll result in less frequent invasive testing, less hospitalization, less antibiotics. So my passion and my message is just use good evidence. And there's lots of good networks around the world generating this good evidence, including in the UK and Peruki, Pern, in Spain, in the US. Yeah, so that's my thought.
And it's been kind of lovely working as Peruki, as part of Pern and some of these wider international networks. It's interesting because there's the science of the study. I also think there is an art of collaboration. And I just wondered, do you have any thoughts on that? There's research on medical science, but there's also the way that you engage with people.
Yeah, Damon, that's why I smile, because, you know, I think I probably spend most of my working life in trying to maximize how effective I am as a communicator, because this goes to your issue of how do we best, the nuances of collaboration. So domestically, let's face it, we all have, our own cultures that are a little bit different, right? Because, I know better how U.S. scientists think and work than I do about U.K. scientists. I mean, of course, we have a lot of commonalities. We're humans, we're scientists, we're friends. But I will tell you my thoughts in the United States, for example, when I'm working, and right now it's funny, I have I just had a chat with Todd Florid, whom you know, who's running the PERN pneumonia study. We're doing that together. And we're setting up an authorship agreement plan. So, for example, authorship can be a sensitive topic. My feeling is that you just get these things, the elephant out of the room, is just early and say, hey, look, let's talk about authorship. Everyone that's going to, fortunately, in these big trials, there's room for everybody, and people with ideas, new ideas off of a trial can be a first author and whatnot. But in the U.S. and PCARN, we establish these things right at the start, because the worst thing that happens is that, later on down the road, someone thinks, for whatever reason, for bad communication, that, oh, they were going to be this sort of author, whatnot. So I'm just really a big believer of upfront communication. We do that in PCARN, and we establish general agreements. And I'll tell you one example of that was, the head injury work that I led. We had about 30 papers from that head injury study. I was the first author on one. And 22 different authors were first authors of papers of that because we established, really kind of good communications around that. So I don't want to focus too much on authorship, but that being an example. Globally, it's a little bit trickier. What we have to fundamentally start with is that we are friends and that there has to be trust, because that is the root of everything that's good in life. Good communication, friendship, and trust. Really important in global collaboration, because some of the nuance of the cultural differences between networks, we don't know about each other. It's hard to learn unless you're living there. So as long as we have good friendship, trust, and communication, then I'm a big believer that we can overcome all. But it has to be like kind of early good communications and stuff.
Yeah, and it's certainly not something that's taught at medical school, and it's not really taught in academia either, is it? It is an interesting thing that the big research collaborators learn the art of engaging with people. There is international variance. I'm always embarrassing myself with the Europeans, because there are things, and the way I express myself, I am sure, is not quite the same way that others do as well. And I sometimes come across, I'm sure, as much more blunt or much more cynical than I intend to. So definitely something to work out.
Let me tell you something funny. Tell you something about that, Damon, which I'm smiling because it totally resonates. I will sometimes send an email that it's kind of a benign email, but it might be that my fuse might be a little bit shorter, and I send an email or a communication, and I think, oh dear, that might be misinterpreted. So then I chase it immediately with another email and say, oh, by the way, there's no anger in there or whatever. There's just, I just need to clarify this. I'm just trying to, but, I smile because we all get ourselves into inadvertent trouble at times because of miscommunication. So that art of communication, one of the great things, though, as you know, is, again, particularly in the PERN world, because we have all been working with each other for more than a decade, I do think there is fundamental trust and friendship. And although we'll have disagreements, because that's part of science and part of life, I do fundamentally believe we overcome them because we do have that fundamental friendship and trust.
Yeah, that excellent. Okay, and just to finish off with, so let's what do you see on the horizon? Or have you got anything specific or new, head injury, DKA, febrile infant? I mean, once we've got COVID out of the way, because I know that's been a bit of a barrier to moving things on over the next couple of years.
Yeah. Yeah, so yeah, Devin, I'll just give you a kind of a quick heads up on what we're planning and what I think is coming. And you're absolutely right. We've all been distracted by COVID because all of us, the truth is, since this is a global crisis, a piece of all of our work has had to move into the COVID world. Although I will tell my mentees, don't make a career around COVID because, please, at some point it's going to fade into the background, and then I'm not sure how much of a research topic it will be. But having said that, with the febrile infant, I think chasing biomarkers to predict who has it, that's going to soon go away. When I say soon, in a number of years, where we're heading with a febrile infant is genomics. And, you know, we've been working on it, lots of folks have been working on it. In fact, we have, you know, competitors in the UK that are working on it. This is, you know, a global issue. But what I think, what we've had historically with the febrile infant is we have screening tests from, you know, CRPs and procalcitonin and absolute neutrophil counts. And then we have the definitive test, which historically is the culture. But we know that that's fraught with false positives, false negatives, delays, etc. What's happening with genomics is that genomics with rapid turnaround is bringing those two together so that ultimately, you know, for us, we're looking at RNA biosignatures. That is the way your DNA, your RNA expresses itself to distinguish between bacterial and viral infections is going to be more accurate than the blood culture. And once it becomes a very short turnaround time, the screening test and the definitive test become one. And it may not be RNA biosignatures, it may be another genomic technique, but that's where we're going. My guess is within 5 years, we'll probably be in a place where the screening tests and the definitive test will become one. I think that's where we're going. And the holier grail than that is that pregnant women will be immunized against the pathogens that cause neonatal disease. And that's another upstream direction, but really outside of our wheelhouse. So that's kind of my thoughts on the febrile infant. And then the other one I'll tell you about, because, you know, we're doing some work on this, DKA, you know, sort of going back to where we started our conversation, we took sort of 20 some years to just show that it's not fluids. We have to stop thinking about fluids. We've got to go to other things. And we have done work. Again, we work with this, as I mentioned, this lab where we have a small rat model of DKA, and we've done tests in kids. And there's kids with DKA, there's a lot of inflammation. And if you look at the rat brain with DKA cerebral injury, it is hugely inflamed. And then there's hypoperfusion issues. So in my mind, the next step in DKA is not looking for a new therapy or testing a new fluid. I think the next step in DKA is getting to a better fundamental understanding at the pathophysiology of brain injury and DKA that will allow us to develop more targeted prevention and treatment.
Yeah, excellent. Thank you very much. And the last thing I'd like to kind of really end with, in our pre-conversation, we touched on this, is we've talked a lot about kind of the big ticket items in pediatrics. So kind of febrile illness, head injury. One of the things that COVID's really taught me, and I think it's something that we're going to have to get with groups in Peruki, but also in Pern, is poverty and social disadvantage and the challenges that COVID has really brought out on what we can do as pediatric emergency clinicians to help that, because it's really opened my eyes. They should have been open before, but I think they are really open now to inequality and what we can do, the things that just aren't disease, but whole population science in pediatric emergency care. And in a way, I'm looking forward to that, because I think that is a new journey that we need to go on.
Damon, I think you're just spot on. You know, I had a conversation with Stuart Dalziel and Terry Klassen the other day. we are planning a sort of a manuscript about Pern, where we've been and where we're going. And I know in PCARN, in the United States, there are tremendous healthcare disparities. Many people have documented them. I've done a few studies looking at racial disparities around CT scan use and analgesia. And as horrific as it sounds, this is for children. Like, and a good example, this is a study led by my colleague. She was a mentee at the time, but now I consider a colleague, Dr. Monica Goyal. But we did a study looking at appendicitis in children in the United States. And we documented this tremendous racial disparity in analgesia for a disease that we know causes pain. So we've actually in PCARN for the last 5 years, we have been tackling this issue. In my note in PCARN, I have a close collaborator, mentee, Dr. Tiffany Johnson, who has been leading our disparity efforts in PCARN, so that now when we develop any study in PCARN, we also take a look through a different lens, through the disparity lens, to see is there something that we should we be studying regarding disparities around whatever topic that we're doing. And globally, as you describe, I know that in Australia there have been disparities between Aboriginal individuals and non, and disparities exist everywhere. And I think that is the next frontier that we really need to, when we talk about making care available to all children, no matter what setting, it also means, in my mind, equitable care, reducing the healthcare disparities that occur all over the world. So I'm so glad you said that, because I think that is really, we're at its infancy at taking on that challenge and resolving that problem.
Excellent. I think that's a great way to finish the conversation. So thank you very much for your time. And I'm sure I will catch up with you again in the future.
Thanks so much, Damien. Really nice to chat with you. And thanks again.